Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 16th Annual Milwaukee Film Festival, featuring local, national, and international films, April 11th through the 25th. Tickets are at mkefilm.org.
Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
40 hours a week in a cube is standard today for the huge numbers of people who go to work every day in an office. But as commonplace as the office seems, it's got a long history, from the counting houses of the 19th century to the steno pools of the 60s. Pop culture has gotten in on the act, too, like the movie Office Space.
I'm going to need you to go ahead and come in tomorrow. So if you could be here around 9, that would be great. Okay? Oh, and I almost forgot. I'm also going to need you to go ahead and come in on Sunday, too. Okay?
Well, our next guest takes up the story of The Office in his new book. Nikhil Saval joins us now. He's the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Nikhil, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you write that the United States is a nation of clerks. How many of us work in offices today?
Well, it's actually kind of a difficult thing to estimate because things are changing so quickly. People who used to work in offices now work from home or work in cafes or all over the place. I think I can say that about 60% of the people who do work in offices work in cubicles, but it's changing very rapidly. And so the percentages are all over the place.
Well, yeah, as you say, now working in an office probably means working in a cubicle farm. But let's look at their ancestors. What were the first clerks like?
Well, the first clerks, I really locate the kind of origins of the office in the mid-19th century. And the first clerks were curious creatures in America. I think people really were wary of office work at the time. It was both new and growing and yet also not how people thought of work. They thought of work as farming or factory work, whereas clerks didn't seem to produce anything. They just reproduced. They made paperwork. And they were often physically thinner than most people. They were pale. Walt Whitman referred to them as a sort of round-shouldered generation of narrow chests. He called them forked radishes. They were just so pale and thin. And, you know, so people were very scared in a way of what clerks represented about the future of work.
And one thing that represented was a switch from manual labor to, you know, working with your body, which seemed wholesome out in the sunshine, to working inside in the dark, musty places where your muscles weren't exercised. How did that play out?
Well, you know, it was a strange shift. I mean, I think the U.S., while it didn't really, most economies just didn't care so much about administration, about bureaucracy, about accounting. But as business grew bigger, especially after the Civil War, business became big business. It suddenly became necessary or considered necessary to administer this work and to keep accounts and just know where your money was going. And so for those purposes, they needed clerks, and they started to build large offices, which, in fact, they actually modeled after factories. I mean, the original offices resemble factories. People probably know the images of row after row of desks in a steno pool or in an accounting pool, people clocking in and out, as in, you know, the film The Apartment or the film Mad Men sort of represents this as well. So that in a way, the office, though it was supposed to represent a kind of escape from manual labor, in a way resembled it in broad outline.
And it didn't look fun.
No, it was that. It was never really considered fun, as much as it was considered prestigious. And there was something about it that was, you know, had high status. The office work has often been considered a middle class occupation. You was clean. You wore the same work clothes to work as you were outside it. You didn't come home smelling of your job. At the same time, you know, at certain points, your income might even be lower than a blue-collar worker's. The work might just be drudgery. It might not be that exciting. So as much as it was supposed to be mental labor, knowledge work, it was not, did not often feel that way to the people doing it.
Well, moving ahead a little bit, around this time, you write about Frederick Taylor. He used time management to revolutionize how factories worked. I didn't know that he also changed how offices worked. How did he put his stamp on the office of today?
Well, one of the major influences of Taylor on the office was the fact that he effectively created the science of management, or he certainly made it popular. What he did is before in factories, people, there was a sort of loose level of control by workers over the work they did. I mean, they didn't control their factories, but they could have some measure of control over the process. And Taylor hated this. He thought that there could be more efficient ways to do this, more knowledgeable ways. And so his goal in life effectively was to transfer the knowledge of the work process to a group of managers who effectively operated out of an office. I mean, they would monitor the work, and they would change it. They would streamline it. They would divide it within an inch of its length. And they controlled the process. So he separated the execution of work from the knowledge of how it worked. So in a way, he created a kind of managerial class. In turn, his acolytes started to rationalize that class. So he had an acolyte, William Lessingwell, who was obsessed with the office and thought offices could become more efficient. He measured how long it took you to get to the water fountain, and would calculate the fact that if you walked 10 feet every day, it would add up to miles in a day, in a year, that you walked to and from a water fountain. So he would rationalize every aspect of the efficiency of the office to make envelope licking more efficient, things like filing more efficient, things like that. So it, in a way, Taylor and his acolytes helped give birth to the big office bureaucracies of the 20th century.
So did he basically make office life more miserable for subsequent office workers, or were there some profound good things that came out of what he did?
Well, in a way, I mean, he did, there were some gains in efficiency. There were some ways in which the division of labor was made more natural, made things work more smoothly. On the other hand, he definitely was out to break the control of workers over work. And so lots of people since Taylor have positioned themselves against him. They tried to moderate Taylor's influence. The whole concept of human resources, of personnel management, of psychology. This was in a way to counter the fact that Taylor was really well liked by workers. And certainly in offices, it was too brutal a tactic. So the workplace tried to use much more psychological methods after Taylor to make people happier.
We're talking to Nikhil Saval, an editor at N+1 and the author of the new book Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace.
Coming up after the news, we'll get into the more modern office, and that's where you come in. We want to hear from you. Do you spend your days in an office? According to some studies, 93% of people who work in cubicles say they don't like it. They'd want to work anywhere else. What do you think about that? What would you think of a future where we didn't have to put in time at work at the office? We could work anywhere, anytime, free-range people. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post over at the Central Time Facebook page. Hope to hear from you coming up after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
People say, I am the best boss. They go, God, we've never worked in a place like this before. You're hilarious. And you get the best out of us. I think that pretty much sums it up.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. That was a clip of boss extraordinaire Michael Scott from The Office. We're talking about office work right now and bosses and cubicles and where it all came from with Nikhil Saval. He's the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace.
And we'd love your take on office culture. 93% of people who work in cubicles say they don't like it. What about you? Is your office work experience pretty good and pretty positive, or is it kind of like The Office or Office Space or the Dilbert comic strips? If you could change anything about office work, what would it be? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, we listened to a clip from The Office there, and it's sort of this absurdist, depressing, you know, view of the office. But there is sort of this cloud of boredom and angst that hangs over the stereotypical idea of what working in an office is like. Where did that, you know, that feeling and that the idea of offices being like that, where did that come from?
Well, it's I wish I could say that it's new or that it could might go away, but in a way, it seems to adhere to even the earliest descriptions of the office. People probably know Bartleby the Scrivener, the Melville story, which is all about doing copying documents endlessly and the boredom that induces, all the way, of course, to the present, to things like The Office or Office Space. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that, I mean, there's this sort of central contradiction at the heart of The Office, and one is that it's a place that's about merit, you know, and about individualism, that you as an individual can start at the bottom and rise to the top of your company. So it's really up to you. In a way, it's about striving. And so that should create a certain kind of competition, a certain kind of excitement. On the other hand, there's so much that you don't control about that. In a way, there's exploitation in offices. There's domination. There's petty grievances, simmering resentments, politics. And all of this stuff can intervene to make it seem like it's not in your control, and it's like a collective experience of a certain kind of, you know, powerlessness. And this is what most films and TV shows and novels about the office depict. I think that's what they're trying to get at in Office Space or The Office, the fact that you know, it's very sociable, but it's also that sociability is also the sort of thing that is kind of covering up for the fact that you may not be able to control your work as much as you like.
Let's get into the cubicle concept itself. I think a lot of us show up to work at an office and, you know, the layout is just what the layout is. But as you point out in your book, these things come from somewhere. Somebody thought of them. What's the origin of the cubicle?
The cubicle is one of the great ironies, I think, of the office. It was invented by an autodidact designer, Robert Probst, who was hired by the Herman Miller Company in the 50s. And, you know, the office he confronted was, you know, another kind of rote gesture of an office, just desks in the center, offices around the side, and people got the offices once they had achieved a certain level of status in the office. And he wanted to free office workers from this setup. He thought that it was not conducive to how people actually worked, which was correct. And so he, over time, kind of worked up this idea based on his own research, on surveys and things like that, and realized that office wanted their own space, but it had to be flexible because he thought the change was constant in the office, computerization, things like that. So in 1968, he unveiled this system called Action Office 2. Probst really thought offices were about movement, it was like a very dynamic, flexible space with three walls. It was meant to be obtusely angled. You could change it if you liked, and, you know, it was meant to be individualized. And what happened is the Action Office got copied by many furniture companies. And as it got copied, it started to turn into a box because managers realized that it was very efficient for cramming as many people into as little space as quickly as possible with as little cost as possible. And that was sort of when the Action Office became the cube. It sort of became a symbol at that point of an arbitrary, callous workplace. Even though they could, at the early on, they could say, look, you have some private space. But I think that feature has been lost over time.
People really seem to hate their cubicles from some of the statistics you report. Douglas Kuplan called them the veal fattening pens. And you even start your book talking about a viral video of cubicle rage, where someone completely freaks out in an office and starts throwing papers and clubbing their printer or whatever else he did. What happened there that spoke to so many people?
Well, you know, it's the cubicle itself. I mean, it is sort of, as a design concept, not very good. It doesn't provide a lot of privacy. It doesn't shield noise. But it's not really the problem. I think things started to change especially in around the late 80s and the 90s, when the workplace itself just more generally became transfigured by changes in the economy, deregulation, the decline of the labor movement more broadly, and the rise of mergers and acquisitions and layoffs that accompanied that. And so the cubicle became this symbol of this, of the transience and precariousness of the workplace. And so things like Dilbert really take off in the 90s, and the Office Space comes out in the late 90s. So in a way, it was not that the thing is bad to sit in, although it often very, very much is, but that it is sort of like a very efficient connotation of everything that's wrong with the way we work and the sort of sense of that the workplace, that work is really corroded in a certain way.
And going along with that trend toward reacting against the cubicle, you see a rise, especially in, you know, Silicon Valley type environments and media coverage of those, of a revolution and changing the workplace and what it looks like. What kind of experiments have we seen?
Well, in a way, there's a real attempt to make the workplace enchanted or justifiable or legitimate in a way, I think, that had been lost certainly by the 90s with things like that Office Space, I think, reveals that. And what you see is a lot of attempts like to make these workplaces sort of like universities, I think. They're campuses, they're self-contained. Places like Google or Facebook, a lot of the Silicon Valley campuses have amenities and food and sometimes bowling alleys, resistance pools, volleyball courts, gyms, you know, things to keep you there, to basically fulfill life needs and needs for leisure and things like that just at work, so you don't really have to leave. I think that's one of the major trends that you see to make work seem like it's, you know, that it's better, or at least make it more palatable.
And yet, you know, it doesn't always work, these upgrades that we think will be so much better than the cubicle. You tell a story in your book about an agency that went from having desks and all the usual trappings of the office to having lockers and tilt-a-whirl, those little spinny things from the amusement park. And people were supposed to meet in those, and there were only a certain number of computers and phones. And it doesn't sound like it went so great.
No, this was the sort of infamous experiment of the offices of Chiat Day, the advertising agency in the 90s. And the thing that there were many things wrong with the concept, but I think the kind of fundamental issue is that this concept was conceived and designed over the heads of the people who actually had to work in the office. And so then it was imposed on them as this visionary idea, in a way not unlike the cubicle or many experiments in that. The office. And so it had no relationship to how people actually needed to work or what they had to do in a given day. So they found themselves tossed into this maelstrom, basically, of work where, you know, they didn't have enough phones, people didn't know where to take calls, it was just like a mess. And situations like this persist to this day. I mean, the technology is better, but what you see over and over are plans like this in some ways being imposed on workers without real input from workers themselves. And I think that's one of the recurring mistakes.
Is there something inherent in office work that no matter how you lay out the office and how you structure the desks or cubicles or whatever, it's going to be kind of boring for the workers no matter what?
Well, I think that it would be a mistake to lay too much emphasis on design itself as a panacea or a solution to things that people don't like about work. Really what you see in design is a tendency to plan for, to kind of solve the problems of work, but actually design can only really accommodate work or hinder it in a certain way. And sometimes make it worse, like open office plans are often bad for concentration, for example, things like that. I think to look for solutions to how we work, you really have to look to the levels of autonomy and independence on the part of the workers themselves. A lot of that comes from organization. You see in Europe in the 1970s, they rejected things like open office plans and cubicles, partly because they were organized in office, and there was traditions of social democracy and solidarity that meant that they could control, to some degree at least, how their offices look and how their work was divided. I think that's the sort of thing that we have to look at in the United States if we want to see changes to really salubrious, you know, helpful changes to the way we work.
Nikhil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Nikhil Saval, editor at N+1 and the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Mm-hmm.